like to maybe define myself as an artist, a teacher, and sometimes a manager too, recently. And also I find myself in a position of being curator on occasion as well. So I find myself wearing many hats in many contexts at this point, which is curious and quite interesting. And I also think is indicative of our times today. And also, I do have trouble with my taxes as well. They go after me continually because I don't conform to the norm. Where do you live? Why don't you live in one place? Why don't you produce work in a studio? How did you do that? Same kinds of questions. So when you're not in that formaté convention, for a lot of people, you're a problem. I recently read an interview by Jeff Wall, and in the interview, he was talking about his photographs, and he was talking about how he liked. They asked a question, which particular photographs do you like and why? And he was talking about some of the photographs that he's done where there's urban landscape coming on the edge of nature. And he referred to it as that zone, a kind of no man's zone, the zone where he felt the most free. And I thought, that's interesting. It's a zone where people, a person would feel free, because it's a zone that isn't so clearly defined, a zone that maybe this could happen or this could happen. So the potential for digression, different ways of thinking, behaving, responding to nature, responding to an urban context. And the two ideas for me, or the thoughts of dysfunctional space, or those no man lands, or those other zones that aren't so clearly codified and defined. And in the interview, Jeff Wall said he found it very sad to see around the Vancouver area, etc., as time is going on, there are less and less of those kinds of zones. They're disappearing, and they're probably disappearing all over the world. Those zones, I think, are also part of how I see art schools. And potentially in art schools where you might have zones of freedom, zones of dysfunction, zones where things aren't totally understood or clearly formatted. In those zones, there's potential dangers, like there is with the tax people, because everybody now wants to measure and quantify. And when you get those undetermined zones with the Bologna Accord, et cetera, and administrators playing a stronger role in the educational process, as is business, and I'll talk about that as well, there's an uneasiness about those particular zones. It could be trouble. And they often are. And I'll talk about one of those troubles. Traditionally, those zones have maybe been referred to as areas of academic freedom, that a person could, as an academic, be protected. I think we've watched over the number of years academic freedom as a concept, with the mechanisms around it disappearing. Noam Chomsky, many others speak about it in the U.S., what happened if people spoke out against certain political positions at this moment, forces at hand were very strong to prevent academics from speaking out. There was a discussion in the last paper about autonomous space and researchers and scientists having possibility of engaging in pure research, another zone that seems to be in danger, atrophying. You know, the big pharmaceuticals, they're the ones that can come in and support a lot of that kind of research with the terms of direction, funding, etc. So those areas, those zones, for me are very important ones. And I sometimes wonder, is it possible to build into programs these kinds of zones? And should they be built in? And if you do, do you institutionalize it? Does it happen naturally? So before I go any further, I'd like to speak a little bit, the starting point for me with this whole thing, in terms of my experience, and not talking as an artist teacher, a curator, or a manager, I will start as a student. And when I was a student and wanting to go to art school, and I grew up in the Midwest of Canada, where there was a lot of these zones, and I grew up in an area where it was extremely cold. You probably wouldn't understand, minus 40 degrees. So you didn't have a lot of other things to do except to really engage in your art practice or involved in your studies. The art school I went to was quite an interesting place, I think by accident. It had fairly radical things going on because it was one of these zones people really didn't understand or know. And it had people like General Idea, fairly radical artists of the time. And it had a place next to it that was called Emma Lake. Emma Lake was like the Black Mountain of Canada. Black Mountain was where all the artists went and did a kind of, you know, it was a meeting place, a think tank. And Emma Lake had invited a lot of very interesting people, Barnett Newman, et cetera, Kenneth Nolan, Frank Stella. The list is very long. John Cage. It's a funny story. John Cage was there. He got lost in the bush for 2 days, I think, or 2 or 3 days, hunting mushrooms. He fell by an artist. So it was a very interesting environment. And one of the key people that came many times was Clement Greenberg, who was a very important modernist art critic. And in those days, he carried a tremendous amount of weight. He was able, in that no-zone area, in a way, implanted a very strong position, a modernist position, that manifested itself in a very dogmatic modernist art, field color painting, and a position that a lot of artists fulfilled and they didn't understand, a Kantian aesthetic based on epiphenomenism, the dematerialization of seeing a painting as a kind of dematerial metaphysical space, which is interesting relative to the conceptual people also speaking about a dematerialization with Lucie Lepard at the time. Now, geographically, Canada is split down the center in a certain way, the West Coast, the East Coast. Canada's a neo-colonial culture. It's like Australia, New Zealand. Doesn't really have its own identity. Now, I studied there, and then after I studied there, I went to another art school. I went to the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. Nova Scotia College of Art and Design was the hottest art school in those days. Our teachers were Vito Acconci, Mel Bachner, Art and Language, Kinnickston McShine. You name them, all the conceptual people were there. They were coming in the studio every day. The school was not an art school. It was an art movement. And it was really exciting to be in an art movement, but it wasn't an art school. And I'll differentiate between what constitutes maybe an art school and an art movement and the importance of pedagogical practice versus indoctrination, because I think they're two different things, because some places are engaged in indoctrination and not in teaching or art practice. For various reasons, you'll see it happen. Because of some of the hats I wear, I was just recently visiting Bulgaria, and I visited Sofia. I visited the art school there. I was invited to see the place. It was interesting. It was strange. The art school, they took me around. All the art departments had naked models in them. I don't mind. Two or three, for the most part. All guys running it. And the guys seemed more like farmers than they did like professors, but that's, like, you know, I'm sorry, my judgment. And even in printmaking, they had nude models. And they were looking to France as their model. It was the top. It was the top of their idea of not even modernist art or contemporary art, modern art. So they're at least 40 years behind. And the students were working very, very hard making their figurative paintings, drawings, etc. I have no problem with figuration. It wasn't about teaching, and it wasn't about an informed environment. It was about an environment that really isn't informed and isn't a dysfunctional space. It was more an ideological doctrine that was being, for all sorts of reasons, relative to, as I said, Russia and its idealization of France and the France that doesn't even exist today, was continuing. Now, Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, which was a wonderful place that had the art press, Caspar Koenig was running it. It was one very radical environment. Great place if you could manage it. Now, part of my role there was I was a teaching assistant. So I was supposed to help people teach. And I was supposed to teach foundation students under the guidance of, depending on who was the invited artist that time. And I was invited, they had invited a lot of the people from art and language and concrete poetry people were in doing projects with the foundation students. One of the exercises they had given the students at the time was to do a drawing or do drawings like the concrete poets did with typewriters. And I thought, yeah, okay, that's interesting. And so all the students had their own typewriter, no figuration, no naked models. So the students were busy doing their drawings. Now, there was a phenomenon that was occurring at Nova Scotia College of Art and Design at that time where local students were coming into the program and they were financing the school. And I'll also talk about the financing of how art schools work, local financing, government financing. And the Canadian system is a combination of a mixed economy, generally speaking. So it's private money in terms of tuition fee and the state of helping as well. So a lot of people coming into the program were from outside. 90% of the teachers were coming in from New York or whatever. Again, very exciting, very interesting. And also a lot of the artists were coming from the outside, like me, but I was coming from Canada, not the U.S. So the local kids were often seen as the dumb kids because they weren't too smart. They came from Nova Scotia, so a little bit backward. So these kids were in the course, and the other kids were in the course, and they gave the exercise. And this particular exercise, they had asked all the students to do these drawings. And so they all did these drawings, and then the next day they were supposed to come back and put them up on the wall, which they all did. Subsequently, there was one of the students who made a very expressionistic drawing on the wall with, you know, looked like a semi-Jackson Pollock painting. And so they were very tiffed by the student not doing exercise and not listening properly to what they had asked him to do. And they inquired, what you were doing, what's going on, you don't understand. And the boy said, well, I did what you asked me to do. You said to make a painting with the typewriter. And the boy had taken the typewriter and he dipped it in ink. So he took the whole thing, dipped it in ink, and he made his drawing. I thought he was brilliant. After that, they canned the exercise. They didn't do it anymore. So the way, the transmission of information, and sometimes the interpretation and the flexibility of institutions to respond to that, I think, is extremely crucial. In terms of the hats I wear, I'm the head of the program LeCen in Paris at ENSBA, and that program has existed for 8-9 years now. It's what was called at first called a research program, and it's still called a research program. It's a 2-year program that doesn't lead to a degree. It is now going to be leading. We give out our own diplomas now internally, and essentially it should become a troisième cycle, which is a PhD program. There's been great debate and great discussion about what should be a PhD in practice in this with this program. No consensus at this point. my solution to dealing with it, because the French want to develop a research PhD program, was to unite with the Royal College of Art, because they have the oldest existing PhD programs in Europe. They have the PhD program that has a written component and a practical component. It's called an MPhil, which is 2 years followed by 3 years, 5 years to make a PhD in practice. Now, they were particularly interested in my program because I based my program more on a position which I followed through with the paper, which is, I think, that art does have its own epistemology. Art has its own history. Art is its own text. Art is its own dossier. And so I really emphasized with my group the importance of production, but obviously with a critical linguistic consciousness. And for those people who are able to write, there was potentially a possibility of manifesting an analytical written component. However, those other people that were involved in research, and for me that can be research that is, as I said, epistemologically linked within its own history, or it can be an informed theoretical position. I think Victor Bergen fairly clearly established that in his relationship to discussing how new media art obviously lends itself more easily to linguistic description than the expressive forms like painting. And students who want to, as I hear it often from my students, I just had a conversation with one of them recently, I don't want to think about theory when I'm making my work in my studio. So I don't want to be polluted. I can talk about my response to that. So this program is under the guise of the École des Beaux-Arts. When it started, it was a kind of studio alternative. I thought it should go into a more academic position within the school itself and in the European in general, and it's something I've pushed. And I am in favor of thinking and working on the development of practical PhD, much to the chagrin of a lot of people, including the people I work with. I'll come back to some of this. I also now will talk a little bit about economy, and the École des Beaux-Arts Supérieures Nationales is funded by the state. It's funded by the Ministry of Culture. So its money is coming from the Ministry of Culture. The person who runs the school is delegated by politically. So they will say, you, there. So it's not a, entre guillemets, democratic process where the American system, normally they have to do a search for a head of a school, and that person then becomes the director of a university or of an art department. It's a very different system. It's a system very much linked to a political environment and linked to an economic environment with a certain ideology around that as a consequence, with its good and bad. And again, I'll come back to the good and the bad. I also now, most recently, for some reasons, I'm the director of Parsons Paris. And Parsons Paris is the sister school. In fact, it was one of the original schools of Parsons New York. Parsons New York is a school that is linked. It's not linked. It's under the umbrella of the new school. The new school gives out the degrees to Parsons New York and Parsons Paris. Parsons Paris students can go to Parsons New York and vice versa. There's flexibility between the two. The owner of Parsons Paris is a finance banker. I always call him a risk banker. And it's interesting when I speak with him, because sometimes I'm talking about how thinking about degrees, accreditation, and it seems like I'm talking more about how to put a trust fund together and how to put a trust fund portfolio together and how to make risk happen. And his attitude is 100% business. He's coming from banking. So these students, unlike the students at ENSBA, are paying 22,000 euros a year, not including the cost of their living. That's a lot of money. It's a U.S. system. The École des Beaux-Arts is under the Bologna Accord, and as such, under the Bologna Accord, it's going through all the reforms of the Bologna Accord. And I have problems with that to a certain extent. In principle, I think the Bologna Accord, in theory, sounds great. The idea of movability, students moving around, professors moving around, sounds wonderful. What I've seen in reality seems to be a problem between the theory and the practice. It seems to be homogenizing the situation, becoming a homogeneous environment where if you don't fit in your tax system, there's a problem. Get rid of it. The Parsons Paris program is the NASAD system. It's not the Bologna Accord, so it's under the umbrella of NASAD. They're the overseeing body, just like the Bologna Accord, which requires and accredits and evaluates every 5 years a program to say, okay, as it would be for Middle State, which accredits the degrees from the new school. Two different systems, European system, American system, France's system, socialist system. It's free. My students, it's not only free, we give them money. They get money for a trip, they get money for production. It's all free. Plus, we give them money. Wonderful system. Parsons Paris, you pay for everything. The other place I'm connected with is the Central Academy of Fine Arts in Beijing. I'm the academic advisor for this school. I've been involved with them for over 12 years, teaching in the school. I was first invited as an artist to do an art jury there, to critic an exhibition, etc. So I've been in and out of China for a very long time, and I've been working with them for a very long time. And I overlook a couple of their programs. I overlook one of their overseas programs, which I'll speak about. We're talking about communist China, which isn't communist China. It's really post-capitalist. The students pay to go to this school. It's not free. There's about 6,000 students who go here. There's preparatory school for it. They get trained through high school to go through it. There are preparatory schools that are private that aid them to get into the school, and they pay a lot of money to try and get in because this is the most important school in China. So what we have is three different economies. We've got the French system, the European system, which is a socialist system, the Chinese system, which is a post-capitalist system, and the American system, which is really corporate capitalist system. All of these are under the umbrella of an educational system. Now, how they all interchange with each other is a little bit of a nightmare and quite complicated and confusing. So when I also hear about the Bologna Accord and how the Bologna Accord is going to homogenize everything, how they will take an Italian student who's studying art and is interested in physics, and the person she's interested in working in physics is a German who doesn't speak Italian and is studying maybe in France. Linguistically, a nightmare. So the rubric is fairly complicated so far. We'll have to see. How marks are transferred internationally. For now, they're only looking at Europe. One of the programs I oversee is a preparatory program for students who want to study abroad. That program trains students to go to partner schools all over the world. So they would go to CCA in California, or RISD, or Chelsea, or different schools. And part of my role is I help set up the partner relationships with those other schools. The students in this program get a very intensive program, trained by foreigners, learn to speak English, to study abroad. They pay over 7,000 euros to do this. multiplied by 5 because the Chinese economy, the RMB is equivalent to 5, so it's 35,000 for us. They will pay for that. They are then going into those other schools, like the UK schools, which charge a lot of money. Now, the present situation in the UK is that in the next 5 years, every year there's going to be a 3% cut by the government for funding. In the process of the 3% cut, that means they have to get more students in to keep them afloat. The UK system, if it weren't for foreign students, would be dead today. So they are accepting a lot of students based sometimes, I wonder, not based on academic level, talent, but it's corporate machine, which is a problem. That corporate model, unfortunately, seems to be the dominant one. I think the Netherlands, France, and a few other places in Europe are not part of that whole system. Now, not being part of that system is wonderful. It's wonderful in many ways because it maybe allows for some more dysfunctional spaces to occur. I used to think, I'm not sure if that's the case anymore. I used to think and I used to hope that would be the case. Unfortunately, because it's not part of the bigger machine, it's not in step with the rest of the way the world is moving today. Because the rest of the world, whether or not I like it or not, which I don't always, some things are good about it, there's flexibility and speed that happens in those environments. However, one of the problems is interfacing. Even a school like Cooper Union, which is a great school, wonderful place, but because it's tuition-free, it's a different system, other schools cannot plug in the same way. It doesn't work. The interface isn't the same. So the collaboration and exchange doesn't happen. So what Bologna Accord wants to do isn't going to really happen because depending on the nature of the systems. Now, I speak about something else that's related to this and to do with the École des Beaux-Arts. And it's that, again, what I was talking about, the space and when people find spaces. Recently, and what I do with my program is every year I take my students on a trip to a foreign country. Last year, I took them, and I do an exhibition, and I do publication, and this is the program Le Sen. Last year, I took them to Singapore, and as I do, I set up partner relationships, and I set up a partner relationship with a school called La Salle, which is a private school. It gives out its master's degree by the Open University because its own regional can't get it together, so they pay for them to get their degrees. And they're also working towards a PhD. These are my students, and also there's a professor from the Royal College of Art. So it's a mixed group. It's my students from the ENSBA, it's the students from the Royal College of Art, and it's the students from LaSalle. My students aren't paying. Royal College are paying a lot. LaSalle students are also paying. I put the projects together, so normally they would spend a month working to do a project. Now, there's all sorts of reasons why I do this and why I have done it. One of the reasons I think it's very good on a pedagogical level that students are placed in environments where they have to react very quickly. And people were talking about this morning, and it's not always good, again, but a lot of young artists have to face internationally moving around and being quick on their feet and adapting to the environment they're placed in. So they might find themselves in a museum somewhere in the middle of, they don't know where. It's not the same language, not the same food, not the same cultures that they have to generally deal with. So part of it is to try and help them train them professionally to adapt and respond to particular environments in a creative way. It's also a desire on my part to put the student in a position where they have to question their own cultural conventions when confronted with the conventions of another cultural group. I am giving them a talk here about their exhibition, and I'm telling them, you cannot do this and you cannot do that. I'm telling them, if we're going to be doing the exhibition, there's no sex and there's no nudity. I'm telling them right out. In Singapore, the law is, it's called the decency law. If you're caught walking around your apartment naked or seen, well, it's illegal to walk around your apartment naked. That's just the rule. Now, if somebody sees you walking around your apartment naked, they can complain. And while we were there, somebody was prosecuted and they got put in jail and they got $60,000 fine. So that's the story. Now, they could get arrested and they could get put in jail for doing this. So I told my students in advance, because we're doing the exhibition there, and I said to them, if you do it, this is what's going to happen. But I didn't say, you can't do it. So I made it very clear, and I left it up to them, but the consequences would be, you know, shit would hit the fan. But I didn't say, you can't do that. So it's an interesting environment, the school. So this Singapore, so while we were there, this festival occurs, and it's very interesting because the relationship to the body. It's one of the only places in Asia where this still happens, where it lasts a whole day and local minority have the festival and it's all body piercing and they're in trances and I couldn't believe it. So the Singaporean government allows this to occur, but at the same time, anything to do with nudity, etc., is forbidden. So one of those, again, cultural strange phenomena. So when I was in Singapore working with the project, and so the three of us worked together, the Royal College, my group, the PhD students from the Royal College, the students from LaSalle, we worked on an exhibition. They worked together. We did the exhibition there. It went well. And after we do the exhibition, we also do a publication of the exhibition every time I do one of these things. Now, nothing got censored in that show. Nothing got censored in that exhibition. Now, I had done another exhibition with the Chinese as well. In the Chinese, working with my Chinese students and my students, again, I spoke with them prior to the exhibition about what the constraints were if you're working in China and working in that environment, that if you do derogatory imagery of Mao Zedong, you can still get in trouble. I don't know if you know the story recently with Ai Weiwei. Ai Weiwei, fairly important Chinese artist. Ai Weiwei is a fairly important Chinese artist, and he had done a critique of the earthquake, that certain buildings fell down and other buildings didn't fall down. And it was the 60th anniversary in China. So he was really pushing the edge as an artist. His father was an artist. He was a poet, and he was also killed by the communist regime. So Ai Weiwei has really been pushing the edge on this particular issue. And just before the 60th anniversary, he was arrested, and he was beaten by the police. He was beaten in the police station, and then he was put in hospital, and then he was subsequently, while in hospital, the secret police came, and they beat him again. And he suffered brain damage, then he had to go to Germany to get operation. So when the line is crossed in those environments, he had crossed the line, and in the process of crossing the line, there were very clear consequences for him. Now, my students in Singapore with that exhibition, if they crossed the line, there would have been clear consequences that would have occurred for them as well. So the Singapore exhibition occurred, and after the Singapore exhibition occurred, I did an exhibition in Paris. I think it's okay now. Nope. I did an exhibition. I'm going to just probably have to not show these slides. Sorry. I did an exhibition in Paris at the École des Beaux-Arts, and it was an exhibition with the students from Singapore, from Royal College of Art, and my program. And I had, as I said, I was curator for the program in Singapore, but this time we engaged the curator from the Royal College of Art, who's the head of the master's program at the Royal College, and she curated it. She curated the exhibition, and with her students, and they did the catalog, and they did all the preparation, etc. And one of my students, who's from Hong Kong, or she's originally mainland Chinese, but she's from Hong Kongese, and I take in my program students who aren't necessarily homogeneous group. I try to get them as mixed up as possible, architects, anthropologues. In her case, she was a sociologist, and her background as a sociologist. As a sociologist, she worked with sex workers in Hong Kong who were from mainland China and had done her master's degree. Her understanding of contemporary art and art was pretty limited sometimes. She didn't know who Vito Acconci was. She had no idea about a lot of this stuff. So she had a crash course and got pushed pretty fast, pretty hard within the program with the other group. So she's coming from another discipline. Again, I think it's this importance of how we mix and crossover that occurs. And so she was working with a curator, and she had done a piece, and I unfortunately don't have it anymore here. It was in the front of the school. She had hung a banner. And on the banner, it had used the quote from Sarkozy, which was "travail plus gagne plus," and she had changed it from that to "work less, get more." And the piece was put in the catalog. The director of the school, assistant director, the financial people—they all saw. And so the piece was up. The curator from the Royal College was quite happy with it. I was there on Wednesday for putting up the piece. Wednesday that night, I got a call from the director of the school who told me the piece must come down before 5 o'clock with no discussion. So the piece had to be taken off. It was inacceptable, and I was called into an immediate meeting because it was a big problem. I immediately called the curator at a professional way of working to inform her. She was very pissed and said, "I'm taking a train back right away." I said, "Okay, well, you know, I understand." But she came to the meeting. And so at the meeting, there was all the administrative heads, all the people from the school, and most of them were yelling at me because it was my fault as a teacher for not controlling my students. Now, that's an interesting idea, that me as a teacher, or our role as a teacher, is to control students. So how... Again, the question of when are you working as a pedagogue and when are you indoctrinating and when are you maintaining ideological structures and what are those ideological structures? What are the systems around them? How do you manage them? Gwala spoke about it to do with her faculty. I also see it on those levels. These are questions I ask myself. So given that question, when I wasn't allowed, in terms of academic freedom, even to respond to say, "Don't take it down," and I would have said, "Don't take it down, because if you take it down, all shit's going to hit the fan." Because I know this student, and she's very smart. She ran with it. The next day, it was in every press all over the world. It hit New York, The Guardian in London, everywhere. I was getting calls every day from reporters about it. Eventually, on Saturday, I got another call telling me, again from the school, you must come immediately because the Ministry of Culture has demanded the pieces be put up immediately, right away. So the piece got reinstated, and the student is now suing the director and assistant director legally, so it hasn't stopped. She's going for the top, and I'm not surprised. Now, as a teacher, I thought, did I not do my job? Well, I told them to auto-censor themselves in Singapore, but I didn't tell them not to not do it. In her case, I think part of my role is to teach students to do what she did, to find those spaces, potential spaces, and how to move in them and function in them. Now, the school is very pissed off at me. Some of my colleagues don't speak to me anymore. I said I will demission, and I will, if that's the case. I think it is a question of academic freedom. Whether or not the piece was a good work of art, for me, it wasn't so great. I mean, she's just discovering Jenny Holzer and Barbara Kruger and all those people. But in her naivety in a certain way and her straightforwardness, she found a space and she got it and went in there. So the difference and working with those three institutions, as I indicated, the system, the mainland China, Singapore, all different kinds of systems. And I had dinner with the director the night of this thing that occurred from Singapore, who's British. And he said, well, his sense of democracy since he's been in Singapore has been not the same as it was. In Britain, it used to be quite black and white. So I think we're all finding ourselves as artists, people working in this environment, faced with these kinds of questions, faced with the questions of transmission of information was spoken about, what kind of information, how it's being transmitted, what are the consequences? So it appears to me that the consequences when information isn't being transmitted properly to corporate capitalism, they don't get their students. And if they don't get their students, they're in trouble and they die. In the system education nationale supérieure, it seems very much linked to a political ideological mechanism that if certain political gaffes are made or not maintained, we're not going to get our funding. So this potential barrier on the front could cause a serious trouble. These four words cause so much trouble in front of the building by a student. Institution, depending on particular institutions, the Ecole des Beaux-Arts, because of its fear of losing its funding, and what I'm saying I don't think is indiscreet because it was in all the journals and all the press, it's one of the ways they're working. The system in the UK, the US is another kind of system. I think in a certain way, a lot of what is happening right now is not totally crises, but there's real confusion. There's confusion about what constitutes contemporary art, what's the subject itself. You know, when you're dealing with a localized situation like Bulgaria, it's really clear. It's figuration. We know what the criteria is. And this is what our students do, 1,000 of them. Other environments where you're getting into a very mixed environment and a mixed economy, the clarity is no longer there. So the models aren't there. They're not existing the way they used to be. The potential, what they would see as problems are maybe potentially higher. I see them as potentially maybe better. In the process of certain kinds of meltdown that's occurring, like I even just saw it with Parsons, New York, and the Free School had a riot almost last year because of the relationship of what was going on in the school. So the possibility at this point is a redefinition, and a redefinition of what we understand this environment to be, how we understand contemporary art, because contemporary art is not just an American-based phenomenon anymore. It's been inherited by those others, Latin America, Asia Pacific, etc., and it's being mutated. And the process of it being mutated, it bypassed a lot of the stuff that contemporary American art thinks about. Now, again, that relates to how we understand teaching, what the teaching model would be for that. In the question of this, even schools like Parsons Paris, art schools, the tradition of the École des Beaux-Arts, the tradition of the Beaux-Arts was the atelier-based system. It's the atelier-based system on the professor giving his wisdom to that students. That system exists in, I think, Spain, Italy, a few places still in Europe, from the craft guild system. The American system was one based on universities, multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, very, very different system. It's an Anglo-Saxon system. The schools like Parsons Paris, they mix up architecture, they mix design together, all mixed up. The French system, superior. They keep it separate. Don't mix it up. Don't mix up your economies and don't mix up your disciplines. Again, I'm not too sure if that's such a healthy phenomena. So the professional practice of professors teaching in the American system who do exhibitions, their exhibitions are often not considered equivalent to a scientist's research. So if a person's asking for tenure, they're asking for sabbatical or increase in position. They will do an exhibition, but it's not perceived as being of the correct stature in that system. So there aren't equivalents, scholarly equivalents, because it's not linguistically founded, as the previous person was saying. It doesn't conform to their models. The heterogeneous nature of what we have in Europe linguistically, the history of our art schools in terms of being based on the Italian system, not based on the American system, now conforming to the Bologna system, how they're becoming increasingly, I think, overseen by political bodies versus academics, intellectuals, administrators, is changing the very nature of how we understand and how those schools are operating. Also, the American system, it's become big business. It's run by people who are talking about branding, corporations, clients, delivery to the clients, feasibility. These two bodies are very antithetical. And then next to that, you have Asia Pacific, another system functioning very, very differently. Education is extremely important to that culture. However, it's a post-capitalist culture. It will buy degrees. In Toulouse recently, there was a scandal with the university being bought, students buying degrees from China, paying for them, cash. The president's in deep shit over it. The students didn't even go. So it was purchased degrees from an institution nationale, a French system. But the economic reality is so strong. So I've listened to the discussion, and I just really wanted to try and talk a little bit more from a experiential, a pragmatic position of somebody teaching. All of the things I listened to today and yesterday I thought were extremely good. The last presentation about the last paper about the nature of a PhD and the demands in terms of writing, this so strongly goes against all of the university system. The resistance is phenomenal. I cannot imagine it passing. If it did, I'll be totally surprised. I personally think there's a very strong argument for it. If we are in a situation of reevaluating, because I think it's a very important moment to reevaluate, my basic thinking is why replicate models that already existed? And why replicate, in particular, models like a PhD model that didn't work for us in the first place, has nothing to do with us. The humanities model of a PhD is based on art historians. It's not based on what we do in terms of practical practice. The scientific model of a researcher gathering data, putting it together, and maybe writing a very short paper or dissertation about that data isn't the same process of what we do. We do a different thing. What we do is different, and in its difference makes it potentially its own area, own discipline that hasn't been part of the Platonic thinking. It's not an inferior discipline. It's part of an evolution that's occurred within the contemporary world today. And I think as it was referred to as cognitive labor, I strongly agree.